Hello, I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch, and it's time for our birthdays. From Benton, Linda Pentico. Happy birthday, Linda. From Fort Dodge, Sheila Benton. Happy birthday to you, Sheila. And from Ziering, Maxine Hansen. Happy birthday, Maxine. And finally, from Montrose, Edna Haneke. Happy birthday to you, Edna. If today is your birthday and you didn't hear your name, give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Now let's get back to the news with our first story from the USA Today. Writing for the Associated Press, Carla K. Johnson, Angelica Castanis, and Kat Stafford. Racial disparities seen in U.S. vaccination drive. Contributing factors include distrust and access. A racial gap has opened in the nation's COVID-19 vaccination drive, with Black Americans in many places lagging behind whites in receiving shots, an Associated Press analysis shows. An early look at the 17 states and two cities that have released racial breakdowns through Monday found that Black people in all places are getting inoculated at low levels, below their share of the general population, and in some cases significantly. That's true even though they constitute an oversized percentage of the nation's healthcare workers who were put up at the front of the line for shots when the campaign began in mid-December. In North Carolina, Black people make up 22% of the population and 26% of the healthcare workforce, but only 11% of the vaccine recipients so far. White people, a category in which the state includes Hispanic and non-Hispanic whites, are 68% of the population and 82% of those vaccinated. The gap is troubling to some, given that the coronavirus has taken a disproportionate toll in severe illness and death on Black people in the U.S., where the scourge has killed over 430,000 Americans. Black, Hispanic, and Native American people are dying from COVID-19 at almost three times the rate of white people, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We're going to see a widening and exacerbation of the racial health inequities that were here before the pandemic and worsened during the pandemic if our communities cannot access the vaccine, said Dr. Uche Blackstock, a New York emergency physician and CEO of Advancing Health Equity. Experts say several factors could be driving the emerging disparity, including distrust of the medical establishment among Black Americans because of a history of discriminatory treatment, inadequate access to the vaccine in Black neighborhoods, a digital divide that can make it difficult to get crucial information. Vaccination signups are being done to a large degree online. It's frustrating and challenging, said Dr. Michelle Fiscus, who runs Tennessee's vaccination program, which is doubling the doses sent to some hard-hit rural counties, but is meeting with deep-rooted mistrust among Black Tennesseans. We have to work very hard to rebuild that trust and get these folks vaccinated, Fiscus said. They're dying. They're being hospitalized. Hispanic people also lag behind in vaccinations, but their levels were somewhat closer to expectations in most places studied. Hispanics, on average, are younger than other Americans, and vaccinations have yet been thrown open to young people. However, several states where Hispanic communities were particularly hard hit by COVID-19 have yet to report data, notably California and New York. Writing for the Associated Press, Kevin Freeking writes, Dems face minimum wage quandary. Dateline Washington. The Democratic push to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour has emerged as an early flashpoint in the fight for a $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package, testing President Joe Biden's ability to bridge Washington's partisan divides as he pursues his first major legislative victory. Biden called for a 15-hourly minimum wage during his campaign and followed through by hitching it to a measure that, among other things, calls for $1,400 stimulus checks and $130 billion to help schools reopen. Biden argues that anyone who holds a full-time job shouldn't live in poverty, echoing progressives in the Democratic Party. With the economic divide, I want to see a $15 minimum wage. It should actually be $20, said Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat from Michigan. Some Republicans support exploring an increase but are uneasy with the $15 an hour. They warned that such an increase could lead to job losses in an economy that has nearly 10 million fewer jobs than it did before the pandemic began. Moderates such as Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Representative Tom Reed of New York are urging Biden to split off the minimum wage hike from COVID-19 talks and deal with it separately. The more you throw into this bucket of COVID relief, that's not really related to the crisis. The more you risk the credibility of the American people when you're really sincere about the crisis. Including the wage increase, Murkowski said, complicates politically an initiative that we should all be working together to address. The resistance from moderates presents Democrats with a stark choice. Wait and build bipartisan support for an increase, or move ahead with little to no GOP backing, potentially as part of a package that can pass the Senate with Vice President Kamala Harris's tie-breaking vote. Democratic leaders appear to be moving toward the latter option with no guarantee of success. Even if raising the wage can get past procedural challenges, passage will require the support from every Democrat in the 50-50 Senate, which could be difficult. Leading the charge is Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont who unveiled $15 wage legislation last week with the backing of 37 state Democrats. His bill would gradually raise the wage to $15 over a period of 5 years. The federal minimum is $7.25 and has not been raised since 2009. Sanders, the incoming chair of the Senate Budget Committee, has said it's fine with him if Republicans are not prepared to come on board. He said the government needed to pump money into the economy to make sure people are not working on starvation wages. A 2019 study from the Congressional Budget Office projected that an increase in $15 an hour would boost the wages of 17 million Americans. An additional 10 million workers making more than $15 an hour would see a boost as well. However, about 1.3 million workers would lose their jobs. There's no question that raising the minimum wage, especially to $15, will put some small businesses out of business and will cost a lot of low-wage workers their jobs, said Neil Bradley, the chief policy officer at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. An Associated Press article is titled, CDC Calls for Masks for Public Transit. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued an order requiring travelers to wear masks on public transportation in the U.S., echoing an executive order by President Joe Biden shortly after he took office. The CDC order takes effect Monday. It states that passengers on airplanes, trains, buses, subways, ships, ferries, taxis, and rideshares must wear a mask that covers their nose and mouth while getting on such vehicles during the ride and while getting off. Additionally, people must wear masks on the premises of transportation hubs, such as airports, train and subway stations, bus and ferry terminals, seaports, and ports of entry. Masks must stay on while awaiting to board, travel, and disembark. In other developments, Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch, who had received both doses of the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine, tested positive for COVID-19. Lynch's positive test result came after a staff member in his Boston office tested positive last week. In Connecticut, a shortage in the COVID-19 vaccine prompted UConn Health to cancel first dose vaccinations for the next week. The Navy announced that about a dozen personnel assigned to a Pearl Harbor destroyer now in San Diego tested positive for COVID-19 and were removed from the ship. Grace Hawk, writing for the USA Today, Black Lives Matter nominee for 2021 Nobel Peace Prize. Norwegian Member of Parliament Peder Eid said he nominated the organization because it is bringing forward a new consciousness and awareness about racial justice. To carry forward a movement of racial justice and to spread that to other countries is very, very important. Black Lives Matter is the strongest force today doing this, not only in the U.S., but also in Europe and in Asia. Eid said Black Lives Matter carries the legacy of earlier racial justice movements, such as the Civil Rights Movement in the U.S. and the Anti-Apartheid Movement in South Africa. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964, and Albert Luthuli and Nelson Mandela won the prize in 1960 and in 1993, respectively, for their campaigns against racial discrimination in South Africa. For the Nobel Peace Prize Committee, This is not unusual to link a fight for racial justice, to link that with peace, Eid said. There will be no peace without justice. And in the Nation and World Watch, from Columbia, South Carolina, South Carolina GOP censures Representative Rice for impeachment vote. South Carolina Republicans on Saturday issued a formal censure to U.S. Representative Tom Rice to show disapproval over his vote in support of the second impeachment of former President Donald Trump. Rice was among 10 GOP representatives who joined Democrats on January 13th in voting to impeach Trump for his role in the violence a week earlier at the U.S. Capitol. A day after his vote, Rice, who represents an area that voted heavily for Trump, said, "It hurts my heart to have gone against the president." From Washington, officer who died after D.C. riot to lie in honor in Capitol. Capitol's police officer, Brian Sicknick, who died at the hands of the mob that besieged the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, will lie in honor this week in the building's rotunda, congressional members said. Congress will hold a ceremonial arrival for Sicknick of South River, New Jersey, on Tuesday night, after which a viewing period will be held overnight for members of the Capitol Police. Lawmakers will pay tribute Wednesday morning before a departure for Arlington National Cemetery, where Sicknick will be interred. From Moscow, Russia warns Navalny supporters not to attend Sunday protests. Russian police have strongly warned against participating in protests planned for Sunday to call for the release of jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny, the Kremlin's most prominent foe. The warning comes amid detentions of Navalny associates and opposition journalists and a police plan to restrict movement in the center of Moscow on Sunday. Navalny was arrested on January 17th after flying back to Russia from Germany, where he had spent 5 months recovering from a nerve agent poisoning. And finally, from Beijing, China's first Haolong 1 nuclear reactor begins operations. China National Nuclear Corporation said its first nuclear power unit that uses Haolong 1, a third-generation nuclear reactor, started commercial operations on Saturday. The reactor, located in Fuqing City in China's southeastern Fujian province, was designed to have a 60-year lifespan with its core equipment domestically produced. Each unit of the Huolong 1 has a capacity of 1.161 million kilowatts and can meet the annual domestic electricity demand of 1 million people in moderately developed countries. Writing for the Associated Press, Jennifer Peltz says feds indict members of Proud Boys. Dateline New York. Two men identified as members of the Proud Boys were indicted on federal conspiracy and other charges in the Capitol riot as prosecutors raised the stakes in some of the slew of cases stemming from the January 6th insurrection. Dominic Pizzola, a former Marine who authorities say was seen on video smashing a Capitol window with a stolen Capitol Police riot shield, and William Pep, who authorities said was photographed inside the building, were arrested earlier in the month on federal charges that included illegally entering a restricted building. Pizzola and Pep, each from New York State, were indicted in Washington on charges that newly include conspiracy. The object of the conspiracy was to obstruct, influence, impede, and interfere with law enforcement officers engaged in their official duties in protecting the U.S. Capitol and its grounds, the indictment says, accusing Pizzola, Pep, and unnamed others of leading a group of Proud Boys and others to the Capitol and moving police barricades there. Pizzola snatched an officer's shield and used it to break the window, according to the indictment, which is filed in court on Friday. Three self-described members of a paramilitary group were charged with conspiracy this month and accused of plotting the attack on the Capitol, but the new charges against Pizzola and Pep appear to be the first conspiracy cases involving alleged members of the Proud Boys. Federal authorities have charged more than 150 people in the siege. Writing for the Associated Press, Mark Sherman, Capitol fencing, more scar or safety measures? Talks of a permanent barrier spark response. The terrace on the west side of the Capitol used to be a popular place for tourists and Washingtonians to watch the sun dip behind the Lincoln Memorial at the far end of the National Mall. Then came the attacks of September 11, 2001. The terrace has been closed to the public since. It's a fact of life in the nation's capital that security measures are seldom temporary. So when Capitol Police Force's acting chief said permanent fences around the Capitol complex should be part of the vast improvements in security needed to protect the building and the lawmakers who work inside, the reaction from members of Congress, local lawmakers, and neighborhood residents was swift and emphatically negative. D.C. does not support it, said Council Member Charles Allen, whose district includes the Capitol Hill neighborhood. Representative Jennifer Wexton, a Democrat from Virginia, said on Twitter, "I believe we can keep members, press, staff, my constituents, and all those who work here safe without walling off the symbol of our democracy. It's the people's house. Let's keep it that way." A petition being circulated online at change.org against making permanent the temporary fences that were erected after a mob loyal to President Donald Trump stormed the Capitol on January 6th had roughly 1,500 signatures by mid-afternoon on Friday. Visitors and residents of D.C. would be punished by a permanent fence, a permanent scar on our beautiful city, and would lose access to this beautiful beacon of democracy, the petition reads. The grounds of the Capitol attract crowds of public events, daily exercise, even intimate moments. Allison Cunningham, the petition's drafter, remembers going to the Capitol grounds to watch the Discovery space shuttle on its final flight atop a 747 in 2012. It's a beautiful and unique place where people love to walk their dogs, take family photos, or photos to announce their engagement, said Cunningham, a former Hill staffer who lives in the area and works in government affairs. Security doesn't have to be unsightly, said Susan Piedmont Palladino, an architecture professor and coordinator of urban design at Virginia Tech. She pointed to the creation of a pedestrian plaza in front of the White House that grew out of the decision to close Pennsylvania Avenue to vehicular traffic following the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City in 1995. "We've gotten some beautiful improvements to the city out of fear," Piedmont Palladino said. The Supreme Court also was blocked off from the public by temporary fences. When the court invoked security concerns to close its front doors to the public in 2010, Justice Stephen Breyer lamented what would be lost with people no longer able to enter the building by climbing 44 steps beneath the iconic phrase, "equal justice under law," etched in the pediment above. The photograph accompanying this article has a caption that reads, "Workers install razor wire atop fencing around the U.S. Capitol perimeter in a city where security measures are seldom temporary." And you can see the Capitol dome in the background, and then with the razor wire in loops across the top of the fence, it kind of looks like a prison. Grace Hawk, writing for the USA Today, "Emmett Till Home Now Landmark, Chicago nonprofit plans heritage site at property." The Southside home of Emmett Till gained landmark status Wednesday, 5 months after thousands of people rallied in the nation's capital on the 65th anniversary of his murder to call for policing and voting rights reforms. The two-flat home where Till moved with his mother, Mamie Till Mobley, and her husband when he was 10 years old, was granted preliminary landmark status in September. The Chicago City Council made the designation official on Wednesday. In August 1955, Till, then 14, was visiting relatives near Money, Mississippi, when he was lynched after being accused of offending a white woman in her family's grocery store. Two men were later acquitted on murder charges, and a grand jury refused to indict them on kidnapping charges. Years later, the white woman involved in the incident said she had been lying when she claimed Till had touched her. Till's mother drew international attention to racism in the U.S. when she decided to hold a public open casket viewing in Chicago and gave permission to the black press to photograph her son's mutilated remains, fueling a generation of civil rights activists. Till's death became a rallying cry for the civil rights movement, the city of Chicago said in a press release Wednesday. Mamie Till Mobley continued to live in a three-bedroom apartment on the home's second floor until 1962, while she worked to honor the legacy of her only child by devoting her life to eradicating racism and improving the quality of life for people of color. The 2,400 square foot home was constructed in 1895. The official Chicago landmark designation will protect the exterior elevations of the home, including roof lines, from significant alteration or demolition. A Chicago-based nonprofit, Blacks in Green, purchased the home last year and plans to turn it into a heritage site. We aim to transform the Emmett and Mamie Till Mobley home into an international heritage pilgrimage destination that celebrates America's great migration story of courage, fortitude, creativity, labor, and love that built our great American cities, Naomi Davis, nonprofit founder, wrote on Facebook at the time. In a letter of support for the landmark designation, the Society of Architectural Historians Heritage Conservation Committee noted that few of the physical places associated with Till's murder still stand. The grocery store, where Till was accused of whistling, has collapsed into a ruin, and a nearby gas station has been demolished and rebuilt, the Society said. Moreover, in September, the church where an estimated 100,000 people filed past Till's open casket was listed among America's most endangered historic places by the National Trust for Historic Preservation, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit. The Emmett Till Memory Project, a website and app that offers virtual tours of key landmarks in Till's life, includes the home in its list of Chicago locations. The project is hosted by the Emmett Till Interpretive Center in Sumner, Mississippi. We believe the home of Mamie and Emmett Till is vitally important, especially considering the social climate of the day, Benjamin Salisbury, museum director at the Emmett Till Interpretive Center, told USA Today on Wednesday. Having this home recognized and preserved is a positive step toward equity by way of deliberate remembrance. In the months and years to come, we hope this and other structures that are part of the Mamie and Emmett Till narrative are protected, preserved, and appropriately commemorated as they are an integral part of our national story. Amid protests this past summer advocating for racial justice in the wake of a series of killings of Black Americans, thousands of people attended the 57th anniversary of the March on Washington on August 8th, held on the anniversary of Till's lynching. Many of the attendees invoked Till's legacy. Vice President Kamala Harris, then a candidate, made a virtual appearance in a brief video segment calling on participants to learn from the work of the late Representative John Lewis, who was inspired to pursue a path of justice in the wake of Till's death. As John put it, "Emmett Till was my George Floyd," Harris said. "He was my Rashard Brooks, Sandra Bland, and Breonna Taylor." There are two photographs accompanying this article. The first one has a caption that reads, "The Chicago home of Emmett Till gained landmark status on Wednesday. The 2,400 square foot home was constructed in 1895. And being an 1895 home, it is a brick. It's very decorative looking. It has bump out windows on one side of half of the house. And it does have a flat roof to it, with steps leading up to a small porch. And the second photograph has a caption that reads, "This updated family photograph taken in Chicago shows Mamie Till Mobley and her son, Emmett Till, whose lynching in 1955 became a catalyst for the civil rights movement." And so it shows Emmett wearing a white dress shirt with a tie, and his mother is sitting next to him with her arm around him, and they are both smiling towards the cameras. And now let's move on to the Register's opinion page. The Register's editorial today: Iowa legislature, don't squeeze public schools. Parents have choice already. Republicans have trotted out a well-worn idea whose main result would be funneling taxpayer money to private religious schools. It's deja vu. Republicans controlling the Iowa legislature and governor's offices are focused on making sure everyone can have a gun, no one has an abortion, and state and local government is further starved by tax cuts. You'd think after 4 years in charge, they'd get some new ideas. Nope. Enter more proposals for school choice. That phrase, as everyone knows by now, is an attempt to put lipstick on the pig of siphoning taxpayer money from public schools to funnel to private schools, and largely to Christian schools, also largely to help families that already have the resources to send their kids to private schools. This year's most prominent version of the same tired idea comes from Governor Kim Reynolds, among the bad proposals in her 65-page bill, an amended version of which the Senate passed Thursday, use public education dollars for a new Student First Scholarship Fund. The amount of each scholarship would be a portion of the per-pupil funding the student's public school district would have received. See sentence above about siphoning money from public schools. If the GOP wants to focus on schools, members could, of course, choose to improve the quality of education in this state for all young people. They could adequately fund public schools to help them retain teachers, reduce class sizes, offer more courses, provide additional help to struggling students, and all the other things districts are already trying to do with too little money. But Republican officials do not seem interested in shoring up public education, and they are calling the shots. They will pass whatever education reforms they want, and there isn't anything Democrats in the minority can do about it. So let's at least recognize the latest school choice proposal for the farce that it is. Let's at least recognize reality, and the reality is that Iowa parents already have numerous options for educating their children. This state has more than 350 public school districts. Current open enrollment laws allows most students to move between districts. There is the option of sending kids to private schools and tax advantage options to pay for them. Beginning in 2018, qualified education expenses for federal tax benefit purposes include K-12 tuition at public, private, or religious schools, up to $10,000 per year per student. Iowa taxpayers can use their College Savings Iowa 529 plan assets to pay for K-12 tuition with no state tax consequences as long as students are attending an accredited school in the state. Parents have the option of enrolling children in one of the entirely online schools that partnered with two rural school districts. You can live anywhere in the state and send your kid to school on a computer at home all day. Taxpayers foot the bill with public education money paid to the for-profit, out-of-state companies operating these schools. And then there is the option of homeschooling in Iowa. Parents have three alternatives for that, including one called independent private instruction. It allows parents to keep kids home and provide, if they wish, absolutely no education at all. With independent private instruction, there are no educational standards or tests or visits from any education official. Do Iowans need more choices? No. And the more money the GOP insists on robbing from public schools, the fewer educational options there will be for the 500,000 students who attend them. Less money to your local high school may mean less opportunity for everything from math courses to extracurricular activities. Less money to the elementary school down the street may mean bigger kindergarten classes or no art supplies. Granted, some Iowa parents and students have legitimate complaints about their local schools. Children with disabilities do not receive enough help. Advanced students may not be challenged enough. Test scores are low. The food isn't great. You don't like the English teacher. Many of these same complaints, valid or not, are directed at private schools. The answer is not to loot state funding for public education. The answer is to value and fund public education. The answer is to return Iowa to the roots that anchored a strong learning foundation for future generations. Register columnist Rekha Basu's editorial today is titled, Iowa Legislature, Don't Squeeze Public Schools, Parents Have Choice Already. Twin bad ideas include what we might call every child for himself. At a time when Iowans are struggling to stay alive and pay their bills, our governor and Republican state legislative majority are fixing to make things more dangerous. Senate File 160, which Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law Friday, requires all school districts to make available entirely in-person instruction during the COVID-19 pandemic. And it's just one of the ill-advised education bills zipping through the State House. Reynolds already requires some in-person school time, except when local conditions are dire. But infectious disease specialist Dr. Megan Shrivness of Fort Dodge told a Senate Democrats town hall meeting Tuesday that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the World Health Organization, and the Harvard Global Health Institute all concur that any 14-day average infection rate over 5% is too risky to reopen schools in person. Iowa's has been well above that, Shrivness said. The state's officially published positivity rate is about 10%, but other data and analysts say it's currently at about 30%. What's worse, the mandate doesn't require masks or ensure that every school has enough staffing, equipment, or physical space to enable 6-foot separations in classes. Yet the legislature's Republican majority in just 10 days rushed the bill from subcommittee to full passage. Shiveness also debunked any belief that children can't get COVID. They don't die as often as adults, and symptoms may appear less severe, she said, but evidence suggests that virus can cause serious long-term impairment to children's lungs, hearts, and brains. And since high school students share adult physiology, they should be protected as much as adults, she said. There's still a lot to learn, and we shouldn't be using our kids as guinea pigs. Lawmakers may push back at that analogy, but their other schools bill, Senate File 159, also takes kids into uncharted and risky territory, threatening Iowa's longstanding commitment to high-quality public education. The act introduces Student First Scholarships, a program resembling vouchers for private and charter schools that may as well be dubbed the Every Child for Himself Act. In her Condition of the State speech, Reynolds framed the plan as one to give greater access to students trapped in a failing school. Let's give them another choice by making sure money isn't their barrier. The proposal combines the worst of school voucher programs, which siphon taxpayer dollars away from public schools, with the individual savings account approach, like that once considered to replace Social Security. Iowa has few private schools other than religious ones. Maybe some students will instead transfer to charter schools created by groups of, say, ideological influencers who share a bias such as against technology or medicine. Currently, charter schools must be approved by the local school district, but if the bill becomes law, they can apply unvetted to the state for approval. And religious schools should be free to use the new influx of public money to teach from a religious point of view, despite the constitutional separation of church and state. The state would create a scholarship fund and deposit about $5,270 for each approved student whose parent could spend the money at their discretion on educational and related expenses. That money would be lost to the students' home schools. The state would pay a private financial management firm to manage the fund. The plan gets a thumbs up from the family leader, best known for its opposition to same-sex marriage and support of gay conversion therapy. To qualify for the transfer to private or charter schools, a student's local school must be considered in need of comprehensive improvement based on below-average graduation rates or because they fall in the lowest 5% of Title I schools, those which have programs designated for low-income students. Abandoning them hardly seems like the way to improve those schools. Iowa schools already allow open enrollment, but this bill would remove limits on that by, for example, allowing higher income families to move their kids out of a district and delaying the current deadline for enrolling elsewhere. I'm extremely concerned with this bill, said Shawshank Arora, the chief financial officer of Des Moines Public Schools, at Tuesday's online forum. Non-public schools don't need to accept 504 plans, which ensure a student with a disability gets appropriate education, or students with special needs or behavioral issues. Non-public schools may not have free and reduced price lunches. Students who switch may not be able to or lack for transportation. Private schools may expect donations, which lower-income families would have a harder time coming up with. So the students who are most able to leave could be the ones who already have all kinds of access, while those left behind would be the ones most in need. Dependent on school district, computer equipment, or subsidized meals, these proposed choice changes would thus transform schools' roles as the great equalizer to instead increase societal segregation, said Scott Ellison, who teaches in the University of Northern Iowa's College of Education. Also endangered is the public school's role as the backbone of small towns. In smaller communities, public schools could be forced to close and districts to consolidate. Some educators predict teacher shortages in such subjects as math, science, foreign languages, and technical education. These would worsen if teachers were hired away by private schools with taxpayer funding. Public dollars need to go to public education, said Iowa State Education Association President Mark Baranek. Education is the pride of Iowa. It has been, But with public funding siphoned away and all but the hardest off kids able to leave for a smaller, more advantaged setting, Iowa's children will likely grow up around others just like them, and school quality will almost surely decline. Iowans who love the state and value its strong educational tradition need to remind their lawmakers that adequate public school funding will accomplish just what these gimmicks cannot, and for the benefit of all students. And Walt Rogers, guest columnist in a Your Turn editorial, says it's time we put kids first. This plan's details make it beneficial to everyone. From my experience traveling across Iowa and visiting with parents and teachers, I am convinced that having more choice in education is vital. Real life stories of change from parents and private school leaders illustrate the importance of choice in education. Scott Montgomery, who serves as principal of a private Christian school in eastern Iowa, shared, "We've increased our numbers this past year because of COVID-19. Parents want in-person learning, and when they get here, they are amazed at the rigor of our academic as well as the social, emotional, and spiritual benefits of our program that come from being in person. School choice is not an attack on public school teachers. I love teachers. They are amazing people, and they do fantastic work. What I'm critiquing is a one-size-fits-all, massive, bureaucratic, monopoly education system. Let's face it. Our system doesn't meet the needs of all Iowans anymore. It's time for us to look at more options built on choice, freedom, and parental accountability. Numerous academic studies have demonstrated that when parent choice is injected into the public school system, schools get better. Expanding educational options through open enrollment, charter schools, the education savings accounts, or ESAs, will not only create better opportunities for Iowa students, but also force greater competition among schools. Competition will improve the quality of education they provide. Zip codes or socioeconomic status should not prevent Iowa's children from obtaining a quality education that best serves their needs. Governor Kim Reynolds' Students First Act seeks to remove educational opportunity barriers. This comprehensive reform plan calls for expanded open enrollment by ending the voluntary diversity plans that 5 school districts currently use that restrict the ability of students to open enroll out of a district. The proposal also calls for expanding charter schools in Iowa and increasing the tuition and textbook tax credit, which already helps numerous families. Reynolds is also proposing a Students First scholarship program that targets students who are stuck in Iowa's failing public schools as determined by federal guidelines. The Students First scholarship creates ESAs, giving students the ability to switch from a public school to a private school. The scholarship is a step in the right direction, but a universal ESA program that applied to all students in Iowa would be more beneficial. The current Ed Choice survey indicated that over 60% of Iowans who responded hold a positive view of ESAs. Opponents of school choice say the Student First scholarship will steal money from public schools. This is not true. The Students First scholarship would use dollars already allocated to students in failing schools. About $5,200 per pupil spending in Iowa is several thousand dollars more than that. The school the student left would have more dollars per remaining student. It's a win for everybody. In her condition of the state address, Reynolds was correct when she stated school choice isn't a zero-sum game. School choice is not about attacking or undermining public schools, but rather about empowering parents with the ability to provide the best possible education for their children. It is time we place kids first rather than school bureaucracy. Walt Rogers is a deputy director of Tax Education Foundation of Iowa, a public policy think tank, and he is a former state representative from Cedar Falls. And now we'll move to letters to the editor. Our first letter comes from Julie Neff of Polk City. Ernst backs herself into a corner. Senator Joni Ernst claims her Iowa constituents are concerned about the integrity of the recent presidential election. She says her supporters have doubts about President Joe Biden's clear win. Ernst could do the right thing and reassure her constituents by telling them the truth. She could make a public statement affirming the accuracy of the election results. She could congratulate the new president and vice president. However, she won't. Why? Because Ernst perpetuated the lies of the Trump campaign. She echoed the falsities of a stolen election and helped put the big lie of election fraud in the heads of all those constituents she now says are concerned. If voters are worried, it's because Ernst helped to create those worries. from Susan Punzek of West of Des Moines, less accountability in education is the wrong direction. The latest attack on public education from Ken Reynolds should not be adopted. School choice without any oversight already exists in Iowa. Homeschooled students need not meet any benchmarks nor show any progress. There's nothing in place to account for their curricula nor their understanding. Charter schools and private schools under Reynolds' latest plan would also not be accountable for providing a logical and necessary agenda for students. Public schools in Iowa already provide support for private schools. All textbook purchases need to be made through the public education system and then reimbursed. If a private school does not provide some of the desired electives, students may opt to attend a public school to fulfill those needs. Administrative costs and record keeping are underfunded mandates for the public schools to absorb. Private unsupervised schooling is detrimental to students. Anyone who thinks it is not should read Educated to get a realistic picture of how it can devolve. The writer is referring to a memoir by Tara Westover that's titled Educated. Iowa used to be the best in the nation in education. Fully fund public education to have a literate population. Our next letter comes from Jennifer Owenson of Des Moines. Many wouldn't have more or better choices under Bill. Republicans want to divert taxpayer money to private schools. This diversion is for a very select population of parents veiled under the argument of educational choice. Let's be clear about who benefits from this choice. These populations do not benefit. Iowans in rural areas. Of the 25 private high schools in the state, most are either in or close to an urban area. Pick up a map and you will see that a high school student living in Harlan or Centerville, Iowa, must drive 30 miles one way to school every day to the nearest private school. Iowans without discretionary money. The average cost of private school high school tuition is over $7,200. In order to afford private high school, a family must be able to afford the balance of the tuition not covered in a voucher, in addition to attendant expenses. Iowans without a religious affiliation. 88% of Iowa's public or private schools are religiously affiliated. Students of color. Compare the percentage of students of color in private and public schools at 25% to that in private schools at 14%. Private schools do not provide an inclusive option. Special education students. The appeal of private schools to parents with special needs students may dim when a parent learns that private schools are not required to provide special education services. Public education has always been viewed as the great equalizer because it is offered to all students no matter their geographic location, income, faith, educational need, and culture. Tell Governor Kim Reynolds and the Republican legislators that this is not choice, but an attempt to divert needed funding from public schools. From Ann Hoffmaster of Urbandale, state capital belongs to the people. It has been disturbing to read that the Iowa House and Senate Republicans have voted against a mask requirement at the Iowa Capitol. I have lived in Iowa for many years, pay taxes, and believe it is the people of Iowa who built and continue to maintain the Capitol. Is it not therefore our building? Legislators and legislative staff and those who clean and maintain the building are at risk. There is overwhelming, reliable medical support for wearing masks to reduce the risk of both spreading the virus and getting the virus. Governor Kim Reynolds needs to issue an order requiring that masks be worn in all state buildings. From David Nelson of Des Moines, Trump must not be allowed to hold office again. The House of Representatives has given the Senate a second chance to get right the impeachment of Donald J. Trump. How senators manage to fail the first time will surely be a matter of serious consideration and discussion by Americans for many years to come. Now that you have had the good fortune to survive Trump's insurrection of January 6, 2021, it is inconceivable that you would not act to assure that he can never again hold public office in this country. He is currently a threat to the reputation and long-term survival prospects of the Republican Party. as he is to our democracy. So the GOP should vote to convict him for the sake of the party as well as for the sake of the country. Trump's Republican Party is not our parents' or their parents' Republican Party. It is a party in the thralls of a psychotic narcissist who fantasized that his supporters would seize Congress and restore him to the presidency, which he had lost by the vote of the people and according to the provisions of the U.S. Constitution and the election laws of its states. For the sake of both your country and your party, please vote to convict and prevent him from doing any further damage in public office. And finally, from Deborah Vandergast of Tipton, minimum wage increase would hurt childcare industry. Please address the childcare crisis before you raise the minimum wage. I own a small childcare center for children with special needs in eastern Iowa, and my center will close if the minimum wage goes up to $15 per hour. So will many others. Childcare centers cannot reduce our staffing to cut costs or realistically raise our rates enough to cover a $7 per hour raise in our base pay. I feel my staff deserves $15 an hour, but there is no way my daycare families could pay twice my current rates for care. Half of the families are low income and rely on child care assistance through the block grant to pay for care. Many families would lose access to high quality, affordable child care, which would have lifelong effects on their children. When high quality licensed and registered daycares are not available, families are forced to rely on unregulated daycare providers that have no oversight, background checks, or training requirements. There are no systems to assure the health and safety of the children or that they are in nurturing and educational environments. Guest columnist Maria Repas writes, Harris faces higher expectations than all who came before her. There's only one direction Vice President Kamala Harris can go, down. Don't get me wrong. Similar to millions of American women, I was honored to watch Harris's swearing in. I was raised in a predominantly sexist household in a former sundown town in the Midwest, so her ascension to vice president was personally inspiring. The fact that a majority of American voters promoted her is evidence that the feigned concern over female leaders, particularly women of color, throughout my childhood was unfounded. Weak insults from insecure, jealous bigots. Intentionally and unintentionally, America put Harris on a well-deserved and hard-earned pedestal that's higher than President Joe Biden's. My social media feeds were filled with memes of shattered glass and declarations that January 20th, 2021 is the last day in American history with all male presidents and vice presidents, a fact that is more pathetic than historic. But heavy accolades come with high expectations that are rarely met in everyone's eyes. In addition to the nation's high hopes and the bigotry she faced during the campaign, Harris will also have to address 4 years' worth of the Trump administration's actions and policies while simultaneously mitigating a global pandemic. Such a task is Herculean, even for the most privileged white person. The difference for Harris is that when, not if, she fails, she will fall further and harder than that same privileged white person. The same political pundits who adoringly coveted her ascent are the same people who inflicted tired, sexist double standards on Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Adding to Harris's burden will be the assumption that because of her race and gender, her mere presence will guarantee that everyone and their individual interests will be fully represented without conflict. This country is already looking to her to advocate for everything and everyone that was ignored, hated, and disenfranchised for the past 244 years. Although this hope may sound extreme, such assumptions have been previously heaped upon women and people of color in the public eye. When Orange is the New Black, a show based on a white woman's incarceration in a federal women's prison, aired, it was a hit. Yet Atlantic writer Noah Berlotsky seriously asked why men were not given bigger roles. He meticulously backed up his arguments with prison statistics on gender and gave specific examples of female prisoners garnering sympathy while male prisoners did not. Despite his best efforts at insisting there was marginalization, I wonder if Bertolaski felt the same way about the overabundance of white men in The Shawshank Redemption, Glengarry Glen Ross, 12 Angry Men, Oz, The Green Mile, Escape from Alcatraz, The Thing, Rambo, Das Boot. The only reason Berlatsky pointed out the underrepresentation of one demographic was because Orange is the New Black is a show by women, about women, and for women. He assumes that if a woman or a person of color is in control, then not only is diversity required, but comprehensive inclusion must satisfy everyone's demands. White people are exempt because whiteness is the forgivable norm. Although I have the highest of hopes for Harris, I'm also confident that her first misstep in office will be met with derision and contempt. The 24-hour news cycle will produce empty analysis of the tiniest details, and political pundits who will question whether the country made an error in electing her. Her mistakes will be the perfect vehicles for polite but thinly cloaked racism or sexism. She looks different from white people. Therefore, she is supposed to be different from white people. As a country, we are so eager to distance ourselves from the hateful Trump administration, but if we're not careful, we'll end up making similar mistakes and reinforcing unrealistic standards for people of color. Harris is human. I honestly hope we treat her that way. Maria Repas lives with her husband and son in Virginia. She lived in Iowa from 1978 to 1999. Your Turn guest columnists, Lyric Sellers and Indy Montalvo Martinez write, "Will Des Moines schools make good on anti-racist pledge?" By the way, I do want to comment on their two pictures that accompany their editorial. They are both wearing masks in their picture, so they're current. Attendance at school should not be a potential entry to the criminal justice system. During the summer, Des Moines Public School Superintendent Tom Ahart made a statement saying, "I stand with our students of color and the Black community who peacefully protest for systemic change. We must all be actively anti-racist." As Black and Brown students who have grown up in Des Moines public schools and have shared lived experiences of systemic racism in our education, we feel compelled to hold Ahart accountable to this promise. We started by writing an equity and racial justice proposal for the district that included the formation of equity teams at each secondary school, changes to curriculum, the removal of the East High mascot, and a district examination of how having police in schools perpetuates the school-to-prison pipeline and disproportionately criminalizes Black and Brown students. It must be understood that our Black and Brown students always carry the burden of oppression. The trauma that experiences have caused our marginalized students must be validated, and we must dismantle racist policies and structures that exist in our education system, which includes the removal of school resource officers, or SROs. The leading concern for those who oppose the removal of SROs is the question of safety. However, these arguments are weak because a sense of safety is subjective. The reality, according to the Iowa Department of Human Rights, is that almost two-thirds of incidences involving police in Des Moines schools were simple misdemeanors, not issues concerning public safety. Data from them also shows that SROs are disproportionately involved in incidences that involve Black youths compared with those involving white youths. Regardless of the data to support these claims, the lived experiences of our students should stand on their own and be enough. Instead of using punitive measures, our schools should be equipped with resources that focus on restorative practices and the mental health of our students. The cost of the district's SRO contract with the Des Moines Police Department is split by the district and the city. Each pays $725,000 every year, almost $1.5 million, to have police officers in our schools. We propose that this contract not be renewed and that these funds instead be reallocated towards systemically changing not only how Des Moines public schools respond to incidences, but also how it works towards solving underlying issues. We need to invest in student support staff, therapists, social workers, and restoration facilitators, as well as training staff on trauma-informed de-escalation strategies that are culturally competent and serve our diverse student body. To fulfill the district's motto, becoming the model for urban education, and to actively be an anti-racist district, the Des Moines School District needs to remove SROs and implement restorative practices. Leading with radical love and creating systemic change is exactly what students are fighting for, and we need community support. Please visit at DMPS Racial Equity on Instagram to sign your name in support of anti-racism. Lyric Sellers and Andy Montalvo Martinez are student leaders from East High School who are leading racial justice and equity work at Des Moines Public Schools. Both grew up in Des Moines and know firsthand how white supremacy thrives in education. Guest columnist Rochelle Chase writes, "Unity wasn't a fantasy in early 20th century Buxton. I'm still thinking about President Joe Biden's inauguration speech, his call for unity, and with it, all that we can accomplish, the wrongs we can right, the work we can reward, healthcare we can provide for all, racial justice we can implement. I know speaking of unity can sound to some like a foolish fantasy these days," said Biden, "given all that we've been through these past 4 years, and for Black Americans for the past 400, unity does seem like a fantasy. But in 1900, unity was even more of a fantasy than now, yet there was a town that proved it wasn't, Buxton, Iowa. As Jim Crow flourished in the country, as Black people were massacred in events such as the Atlanta race riot of 1906, and Ku Klux Klan membership grew to several million across the nation, even in the farming communities surrounding Buxton, Black and white people in Buxton were treated equally and lived and worked side by side. Established by the Consolidation Coal Company, owned by the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad, Buxton repeatedly became the largest unincorporated town in Iowa with a population of 5,000, of which by 1905, nearly 55% were Black. Not only were Black people treated the same as white people, they were leaders in the community. They were doctors, teachers, lawyers, postmasters, and postmistresses, company store clerks, miners, justices of the peace. They owned hotels, restaurants, real estate, grocery stores, pharmacies, and more. The fact that Buxton existed at this time was truly unbelievable. And as white supremacists have grown bolder these last 4 years, it's just as unbelievable today. But there are lessons to be learned from Buxton. Protests last year turned the spotlight on the institutional racism in this country and the fact that it has led to unequal access to housing, employment, healthcare, education, and entrepreneurship, along with excessive and aggressive policing and more, continues to plague the nation. But it did not plague Buxton. In Buxton, Black and white families lived in identical one-and-a-half-story company houses with quarter-acre lots, or they could build their own house on company land. Black and white miners rode the same company cars to the mines, where they descended below ground on the same elevators to work in the neighboring rooms, and on payday received equal per ton mined pay. Monthly, money was deducted from their pay for medical services. Residents desiring to start a business could join one of the 40 plus other independent business owners using their own money or with the help of a loan from the company bank. Children trudged down dirt roads to two-story schoolhouses to be taught by both Black and white teachers. From its beginning, equity and equality, not systemic racism, underscored the foundation of Buxton. This had a significant impact on people thriving and getting along just as it does today. Everyone seems like they had a good life because they had money, said Charles Linger in 1981 when interviewed about his life in Buxton. That's why they got along. There's a lot of truth in that statement. With everyone having equal access to the same resources and making a good living, what was there to protest? If that were the case today, what would there be to protest? By 1922, Buxton was gone because the mines had played out and operations and people moved elsewhere, not because the town had been torched and its residents murdered as it happened during the Tulsa Race Massacre in 1921 or the Red Summer in 1919 when massacres and lynching of Black people erupted throughout the country. If equality could prevail in a small town at a time like this, why can't it today? History, faith, and reason show the way to unity, said Biden. Buxton is an example of that history. Buxton is an example of what happens when we try. Rochelle Chase is the author of Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa, and Lost Buxton, a former journalist for Iowa Starting Line and founder of an upcoming nonprofit, Uniting Through History. That's it for our second hour of The Register on IRIS. We are so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.